Hello, everyone, and welcome to this new episode of the TFDI podcast brought to you by the Trade Finance Distribution Initiative. As you know, here we discuss trade finance market trends, the evolution of the originate-to-distribute model, and just about anything related to trade finance distribution. Today, we're lucky to have not just one, but two impressive guests with us on the podcast. Walter Gontarek is the co-founder and CEO of Channel Capital Advisors, a London-based credit investment manager offering working capital, supply chain, and trade finance solutions. And Dawi Aboucher also works at Channel Capital, overseeing the firm's ESG finance activities. Today, we'll be talking about the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on trade finance and credit markets, and how the growing popularity of ESG investing can influence trade finance distribution. Walter, Dawi, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much, Melody.
Thank you for having us, Melody.
So Walter, let's start with you. As an investment manager that sits between institutional investors and the trade finance sector, you're very well placed to observe the consequences of the COVID-19 pandemic on both these markets. So can you tell us a little bit about the impact of the crisis on credit markets and on the trade finance sector?
Absolutely, Melody. So first of all, good afternoon, everyone, and I hope everyone is reasonably safe and healthy and continuing to be disciplined as we climb our way out of this. That's a great question you ask, and you've helpfully broken it up into two pieces, Melody. You first of all have talked about credit markets, and then you've also identified trade finance markets. When the pandemic was first really struck Western Europe, for example, in North America, there was a significant impact to stock market valuations and fixed income market valuations. And in response to that, the policymakers stepped in and took a very important set of actions, substantial actions, not only providing ample liquidity, and we've seen that, and we've seen the ballooning of government balance sheets, but very importantly, the cost of money has dropped a lot. And that means for investors, yields have dropped, returns have dropped. I'll give you a couple of examples. About 40% of all investment grade assets now are trading close to a 0% yield. Portugal, around Christmas, issued a 10-year bond at a 0% yield, and it traded yesterday still at zero. So this is not a very attractive return. You're simply parking your money and hoping to get it back over time. So in the capital markets, what we have is a situation whereby investors, savers, wealth managers, insurance companies, pension funds, and the like are scrambling and looking for yield. It's so important for insurance companies to have a yield. I'll just choose insurance companies as a brief example. They have their assets in high quality fixed income and other securities to cover policyholders. But the return on those assets, on those investments, pay expenses, simplistically. So having a positive yield is very important to investors, to wealth managers, to pension funds, to savers. 2021 presents a really unique challenge to investors to realize a yield. So this is one impact of COVID. The other aspect is the trade finance markets. The trade finance markets arguably overlap with the capital markets because you can do a securitization of trade finance assets, which we regularly do. But they're also separate. And in trade finance markets, the situation is a bit complex. We know a couple of things. Number one, we know that according to research from Standard Chartered, the amount of the trade finance gap has grown significantly during 2020. We know that that means that there's significant unmet need for trade finance globally. In particular, one area I look at heavily, and we talk to development banks, is, for example, in Africa and SMEs. There's just not enough finance to go around. So we know this from research that this gap is getting larger, the need is greater. We also know that from the supply side of finance, commercial banks, a number of commercial banks are focusing and reining in their risk appetite. They're looking at these products in these markets, and they've decided to reposition themselves. So I've seen headlines about ABN AMRO and other banks curtailing their interest in selected trade finance markets. And this is understandable given the constraints they face by the regulator and by their own stakeholders. So we really face a trade finance market where the size of the gap is larger, the size of the need for financing is greater on one hand, and on the other hand, certainly some of the strong players in the market have a more refined and maybe constrained risk appetite. Now, one of the things I spend a lot of time thinking about, Melody, is that we're now in a special time in economic activity. Certain sectors are haves and some sectors are have-nots. What happens say this time next year, when the economy starts to come back and the benefits of the vaccines are kicking in and economic activity begins to really come back strong, how will we tackle this larger trade finance gap? And I think this is maybe an entree in how institutional investors are looking at this gap and wondering whether this is the time to get involved.
I wonder then if the pandemic has increased in any way the interest from institutional investors into trade finance assets. And if so, what exactly pushed them towards these assets? Can you give us a few more details about the factors related to the pandemic that may have influenced this behavior?
Sure. So obviously, as I've already mentioned, there's lower returns in traditional asset classes in fixed income and corporate bonds. And that has created a real incentive to look elsewhere for yield. For example, using the US dollar, the US yield curve as a proxy for global returns, short-term yields are expected to be close to where they are now into 2023. So investors are scrambling for yield, as I said earlier. On the back of that, though, when they look around, what options, what is available for them to invest in? When you look at the global trade finance market, which is a significant size market with a trade finance gap, with short-term trade flowing and short-term financing opportunities, often self-liquidating, with a very good track record according to ICC statistics that generate and suggest low default rates and high recoveries. It looks like an oasis in a very difficult year in front of us to investigate for sure. Dawi, what have you found?
Walter, on my side, I've also seen governments increase recognition of the need to address issues such as climate change, and they've taken strides through policy and regulation to address this. Also, it's important to note the pandemic has spotlighted inherent economic and social inequalities in our systems and ways of life that need to be addressed and fixed. But this growing interest in the asset class is not only driven by the government demands and the pandemic, but also the recognition of businesses' responsibility to the environment and to the society. There has been a shift in consumer demands in recent years, as we've seen the rise of sustainable and ethical products and services. We've also seen an increase in the supply of financing due to millennials. Us millennials get a bad rap most of the time, but in the area of sustainability, a lot of us want our investments and work to reflect the lives we want to live. And it's great to also see our investors and clients coming on board and going on this journey with us in promoting and creating an ethical and equitable working world.
I know that Channel Capital signed a partnership last year with NN Investment Partners to launch a flexible trade finance fund for institutional investors. And what stood out about that was the inclusion of very strict ESG criteria in the portfolio selection. So I wonder if, Dawi, you could tell us a little bit about how you think that the growing trend of ESG investment could play into the development of trade finance asset distribution.
Melody, it's truly encouraging to see the growing movement of ESG and sustainability. Walter and I have been speaking about sustainability and the need for increased sustainable supply chains and trade finance for the past 2 years or so. And I've had the opportunity to serve as a senior advisor for Channel, advising namely on ESG and sustainability for the past year and a half. And recently, I'll be spending my full-time efforts in a new and exciting mandate where I'm tasked with embedding ESG and sustainable finance at Channel, both through our operational models, but also collaborating with our clients and investors to meet their demands and assist them with their challenges. In regards to the NNIP Trade Finance Fund, this is a very important initiative, and Channel is excited to be originating assets and supporting them in the management of their fund. Sourcing ESG-friendly assets for the fund is one of the reasons my job at Channel is really exciting. The asset class lends itself nicely to fulfilling the aspirations of the ESG and sustainable finance mandate, but also meeting the targets for the 17 SDGs outlined by the United Nations. ESG, in its simplicity, is, in addition to the traditional financial models, is taking into account social, ecological, and governance factors. Basically, a company's direct impact on the environment and society, as well as its operational model. 80 to 90% of the world's trade depends on trade finance through either financing or credit insurance. And according to McKinsey, the typical consumer's company supply chain creates far greater social and environmental costs than its own operations. Thus, trade finance is a critical piece of the sustainability puzzle that cannot be ignored. The traditional loans and financing options by the sector have been mostly short-term in nature. But when we add a sustainability lens beyond the policies and procedures and ask ourselves the critical questions, does trade live up to certain ecological, social, and operational models we want to support, we have the opportunity to shift short-term loans to a longer-term return that takes into account risks and opportunities and ultimately transitions towards a better working world. Investors and asset managers are currently defining the parameters. And I aspire to see in the near future, more of us moving past the exclusionary model of not investing in certain sectors such as weapons and tobacco to incorporating an engagement method where we embark alongside our clients on a transformational journey. In essence, that we will still invest in sectors that may not currently meet sustainability standards, but over time have the potential to transition to becoming more ethical and sustainable. It's important to mention, beyond the positive impact on society, that embedding ESG in trade finance also addresses the asset owner's risk problem because it ensures top-line risk mitigation. It improves companies' capabilities and reduces risk.
I wonder what are some of the remaining obstacles to both trade finance distribution, but also to the inclusion of these ESG criteria in this type of investment? And also, how can these remaining obstacles be overcome? Maybe we can start with you, Walt.
Some of the challenges we face is how do you get the transparency, the information to make informed decisions? It's great to know that the generalized default rate on trade finance loans or performance guarantees is low, but when you really want to go in and look at specific transactions, specific sectors, how can we analyze them? Data is important because data informs. Data about delinquencies, data about defaults, data about recovery rates and loss given default, data about pricing on underlying commodities and trends and about industry trends are critically important. What we've tried to do is spend the last year, Melody, in really enhancing our risk management toolkit. We've looked at adding significant amount of fintech to analyze both sellers and borrowers, as well as debtors on receivables transactions. We use Wiser Funding. We also look at S&P and a whole variety of different tools that are out there to analyze the credit risk. We've internally developed a liquidity tool that is relying on AI to measure the liquidity of our clients. By using EU open banking, we conduct bank account scraping, and that enables us to predict forward liquidity needs for our clients given their past history. So we can work with them for their own customer experience and we can better predict their liquidity needs. We've enhanced our AML and KYC activities with a new scorecard, and that's being put into a dashboard format shortly. And lastly, we looked at also managing our fraud risk. We think that the incentives for fraud over the next several years in trade finance markets may be greater as markets continue. So we've really looked to develop a stronger toolkit in order to work with our investors, our insurance companies, our stakeholders, and our clients to make the best possible portfolios and to educate our investors on the asset class with real data, real track record, and hopefully reduce the cost of capital in these capital market transactions for trade finance. In terms of what can be done to improve the process going forward, would be any efforts I would encourage, and there are several, any efforts across the industry to share data. Of course, data sometimes is subject to GDPR and other limitations, but any opportunities to share data to increase understanding and to drive analysis and better decision making would be very welcome. That's a general comment with respect to risk management. How do you find a DALWI in terms of ESG specifically?
Walt, I think you've hit the nail on the head. One of the biggest obstacles is the lack of useful data and the fragmented information, both on the client side with the availability of data, but also being able to verify that data independently from a third party, especially in the trade finance sector. Unlike the equity space, where clients are public and data is plenty, in our space, many of our clients, as you know, are privately held and there is not much publicly available data to it. Also, geographically speaking, we service clients in both emerging markets in Asia and Africa, and also in developed markets. So ensuring that we have global coverage on that data is very important to us. I hope with the growth of the space, we'll see increased guidance from industry groups and data providers. But however, we must continue to collaborate and work in unison to create industry-wide standards rather than fragmented and incompatible standards. At Channel, we're working with data providers, our underlying clients, and our partners to find solutions to this challenge and unlock valuable insights to improve end-to-end transparency.
Great. So thank you so much for all your insights so far. It's been a really interesting conversation. I like to end on a more personal note, asking all my guests to share their latest inspiration, whether trade finance related or not.
Thanks, Melody. So for me, I think it's just it's a great time to see such an outreach by global investors to start looking at the asset class. We've seen global reinsurance companies, asset managers, fund managers contact us and other participants in the market to learn more. And I think it's just it's a wonderful time to participate in that journey and try to have good outcomes for investors globally.
I might be a little rebel, but I'm a firm believer there's enough capital in the world to tackle, if not all, most of the world's pressing problems. And I'm excited to be in my current role at Channel and working with our partners, our clients, and working with my peers within the broader sector to continue to drive this ship and to ensure that we truly create an equitable workplace, but also an equitable world where we'll be proud for our grandchildren to grow up in.
That's great. I can tell you're both very passionate about what you do, because I gave you the option to tell me about something that's not trade finance related, but you both gave me something trade finance related. So that's great. So with this, I'm going to conclude this episode. So thank you so much, Walter and Dawie, for taking the time to share all of these wonderful insights. I also want to take this time to thank everyone who listened to this podcast. And if you have any questions or comments, feel free to reach out to us in the comment section.